that, you know, it's like how kids talk about baseball players. That's how we talk about albums.
We're just trying to postpone mortality.
They need that to fill some kind of void that they have.
The search for the Yeti.
He's a duck.
Well, don't interrupt.
Hello and welcome to the Smashing Pumpcast. I'm Frank Garcia Hale.
I'm Pat O'Brien, and we're very excited to be joined today by a musician who you may know from Peter Hook and the Light and your own Smashing Pumpkins. All the way from Manchester, UK, Jack Bates is joining us.
Hello.
Jack, welcome. Thank
How
you
doing?
So much for... We're good. We're excited to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining us. I know we're about 8 hours apart, so we're we're starting our morning.
It's dark where I am.
Right, and it's I'm still sipping coffee over here. So, we're very excited to chat with you.
And I'm very excited to chat with you too.
Yeah, our listeners are excited to hear from you too.
Oh, cool, that's nice.
And they have some questions.
Yeah, we had reached out to them for questions, and I think we got more people saying, "Oh, that's so awesome, we love him," like more than the questions. We got a lot of positive feedback.
That's the main question, more than is, so we love him, he's awesome. So,
all right. As long as the feedback is in the majority and positive, then I guess we can think of our own questions.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we want to talk about, you know, a lot of different things, but obviously you are the bassist, the touring bassist for the Pumpkins. They have a very, you know, passionate fan base, and it's kind of at this point, you know, a multi-generational band. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of part of the younger generation of that, or the new, you know, one of the newer additions, but mm-hmm. have you found that people are cool to it seems like it, but have you found that the, you know, the feedback you get from fans is positive?
Oh yeah, I mean, well, in the vast majority, the overwhelming majority is very positive, but you get a couple of trolls, as I'm sure everybody does.
Sure. We even get our taste of that on the band's behalf. We get some.
Oh, really?
We're aware. Yep. We're aware.
Brilliant. We're aware. It's not just me then. That's nice.
As
my dad says, the thing is with social media, you get the good side and the bad side. And as long as the good outweighs the bad, then you're doing all right.
Right. Yeah.
And in this case, the good definitely outweighs the bad. Everyone's been very lovely, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the side of the band we like to, or the, you know, the world of the band that we like to live in and focus on.
Absolutely.
Well, you mentioned your dad, and your dad is a well-known musician in his own right. He's your dad, but he's also your bandmate as well, Peter uh-huh. Hook. People will know from, you know, Joy Division and New Order fame, and then also you guys performed together as Peter Hook and the Light.
Yeah.
Was that something, so obviously you came from a musical background, that goes without saying, but did you, were you exposed to it by your parents? Did they say, here are instruments, here's a bass, or was it just something that was going on in your family and you took interest and you sort of just got curious on your own?
Yeah, I think it was just pretty natural, really. Nobody ever said, you know, oh, you've got to be a bass player like your dad. You know, it wasn't anything like that. And I mean, at school, at primary school, I was terrible at music. I mean, I just couldn't play anything. When we used to have to play with recorders and trying to teach us mm-hmm. keyboard and shit like that, and I was terrible at music. And I still am, to be honest. I still wouldn't know the difference between a crotchet and a quaver, which has got me in trouble a lot of times at school. But
those recorders never sound good. I don't
understand how that shitty little instrument became the go-to primary school. Certainly in the UK, you had to play the recorder. It just blew my mind. Even at that point, I was like, why are you giving us a recorder? Just give us a drum kit. Or give us a guitar. Sure.
At least you could get excited. Yeah, first of all, I don't know if there probably are recorder masters out there. Probably,
oh, I'm sure.
I feel like no one's ever heard it sound good. So no. why let that be?
Why are we still pushing?
Exactly.
This?
Right. And at my school, if you were rubbish on a recorder, they just gave up on you in music class. So it was like, wow. even when I started teaching myself to play the bass, it was very much not from a music theory standpoint. It was just sort of learning riffs and stuff like that. But my dad was pretty excited when I started playing, but he certainly didn't try and make me play. And he also, which I couldn't get on board with at the time, but he also refused to teach me because then he just said, well, you're just going to end up sounding like me. And I'm probably, even though he's one of the greatest bass players ever, technically, I think you'd be the first to say that he's not one of the most technically proficient bass players. So he's like, you'll pick up all my bad habits if I teach you. So I had to do it all myself. But then now I'm thankful for that because I've definitely developed my own kind of style and learned different techniques that he isn't into or doesn't want to play. So it actually worked out better.
Right.
But my mom was very, because I was quite good academically at school. And I think she sort of, the alarm bells were ringing when I started playing guitar. She wanted me to focus on the academic side. But no, they never pushed me. It's just sort of a natural thing.
It was probably more enjoyable, I imagine, to just further separate it from sort of school or the whole recorder thing. Like if your dad were then teaching you this is the right way to play bass, you know, I would imagine, you know, playing along, learning riffs to your favorite songs is a more personal kind of
It's more enjoyable,
easier
for sure.
Road.
And I think, to be honest, if he was teaching me, I think we would have fell out more times than we would have had a good lesson. So,
right. You wouldn't be, playing in a band together necessarily. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, what were your, obviously you are very involved or very aware of your dad's bands, but what were your bands growing up, like as a teenager? What were the Pumpkins among the bands that you were into?
Oh yeah, definitely. Probably when I was about 14, I think I got Siamese Dream. And then from that point on, became one of my favorite bands. And still today, it's weird sort of like being around them and playing with them because they're still one of my favorite bands that I listen to when we're not on tour. It's still, you know, in heavy rotation still.
Really?
And it's pretty crazy, but they were definitely up there as one of my favorite bands and still are. I like all, my dad takes the piss out of me because I'm usually like, oh, you just like all those 90s rock bands. I'm like, well, that's my thing, you know.
Sure.
You've got your 70s rock band, so let me have my 90s rock band.
Right, exactly. Yeah, us too. It's how, yeah, I mean, if that's, you know, it's like your moment in time has a lot to do with it, kind of, you know.
Yeah, what were some of your other favorite bands at that time? Or even now?
I mean, probably bands like Dinosaur Jr. Alice in Chains. Soundgarden. I was very much into the whole sort of grunge Seattle 90s stuff, and still am, to be honest. That was kind of what brought me up. And then, the Pumpkins, definitely. Afghan Whig. Mark Lanegan, stuff like that. Nine Inch Nails. Did I say Nine Inch Nails? I can't remember. Yeah, they're one of my favorite bands too. There's a lot. I listen to a lot of stuff, and Metallica, if I want to get heavy. I do like a bit of metal too.
Oh yeah.
And I still listen to all these bands today, which is cool.
Yeah, you're in good company there because we love all those bands.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So you mentioned your dad sort of ragging on the 90s or just lightly poking fun at you liking these 90s bands. Was there, because your dad is, you know, he's part of these bands that are sort of in a unique way, like perennially cool. They're like, did you get to have the experience? Cause I feel like for Frank and I, like we, you know, it's the experience is very pronounced of like your parents not understanding your music or being freaked out by your music or, you know, whatever. But I think for us, like among that music was Joy Division. So like, did you ever get to have the experience of like screaming at your dad, like, you just don't understand my music? And would he respond with, actually, yes, I do?
Yeah, totally. He's probably, if I said you don't understand my music, he probably said, well, I created it in a way.
Right. Yeah.
But it's cool. I mean, it was funny really, because I didn't really get into, you know, I was aware of Joy Division, but I didn't really get into Joy Division until we started playing it in 2010. Because obviously when I was growing up, New Order was the active band that he was in. And right. Joy Division was just something that I was aware of, that they played a couple of songs by them now and again. That was, and then sort of when I got a little bit older, that was when I started getting into it. And then when we came to start playing those songs in 2010, when I would have been, 20, 21, 20, that was when that was sort of discovered for me, which is cool. And now I like both equally, really. I couldn't, if you asked me to pick between Joy Division and New Order, I don't think I could.
Yeah, same. I mean,
some people like to separate them. I just sort of see it all as, I sort of see it as Joy Division / New Order, all under one umbrella. Just a lot of great music.
Yeah,
you don't have to pick one.
Progression, yeah.
Right.
You can just
right.
like both.
For sure. What would you say are some of your favorite bassists from playing all these years and, you know, listening to so much music, and your taste, I'm sure, like you say, kind of goes all over the place. But what are some of the bassists that you were inspired by or that you enjoy watching now?
Number one is probably Eric Avery from Jane's Addiction. And it's funny because he says his number one is my dad. So it comes like a full circle thing when we all met each other for the first time. It was fun. I was sort of really nervous being around Eric, and he was a bit nervous being around my dad. So it was a weird vibe for five or 10 minutes, but then it was cool after that. But he's probably my number one bass player. Just what he does with a bass is so different to anybody else. And the way he just drives the songs uniquely, it's almost like when you listen to some Jane's Addiction songs, he's kind of doing his own thing separate. He's not in a rhythm section. He's just on his own doing this amazing stuff. I mean, when you listen to stuff like 3 Days. It's just, to me, that song is just like bass odyssey. And so without a doubt, he would be my number one. I've been very lucky to meet him a few times as well, and it's been really, really cool, super nice guy, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. But yeah, I guess some others, that's like probably Cliff Burton from Metallica.
Yeah, I was about to ask about that since you mentioned Metallica. Yeah, one of the greatest bassists of all time.
Oh, man, ridiculous. And I can't really play many of his songs, but that doesn't stop me trying. I remember I was very happy when I was about 15 or 16 that I nailed the first half of Anesthesia, the bass solo from Kill 'Em All.
Oh, man.
And then sort of when the drums come in and it goes a bit crazy, that was when I had to check out because I wasn't good enough at that point. So he's up there.
You have to know bells, though.
Yes, yes, yes. And so he's up there with Eric and probably Carlos Dengler as well from Interpol. Because, I do sometimes listen to just the solo bass tracks on YouTube for Interpol songs, and it's just like, it blows my mind.
Yeah,
especially from those first two albums.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, and to be honest, the third one as well. That gets so. I mean,
obviously he did the first four before he checked out, and I don't really like the fourth one, I gotta be honest, but the third one as well is underrated.
Yeah, it's definitely missing that kind of that magic.
Yeah.
Of the rhythm. Yeah.
He's definitely one of my favorites, and Lou Barlow from Dinosaur Jr. Just the way that a bass can be played, how he plays it, is just ridiculous. I mean, if you think of a band like Dinosaur Jr., full of guitar solos, and all you're hearing underneath the guitar solos, because they only have one guitar player, is this wall of bass, which I was very much sold on as a teenager, and still am today.
Right. Have you ever met him? Have you ever worked with him?
I have met him once briefly, but I've never worked with him or anything, but I have met him.
Yeah.
A nice guy.
Music. Yeah, we've seen them live a couple of times, and they're always amazing.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I mean, always ridiculously loud. earplug territory for sure, unless you want to get tinnitus like me. But they are crazy live.
I did a little comedy thing with Jay Maskus, who as a person is not loud and is almost the opposite. He's inaudible, almost mute. Yeah. He's a man of very few words. He was great. He was really funny and
oh cool.
Had a good time. But he in contrast to his concerts, he is like the quietest man around, which I think makes sense.
Dinosaur Jr., Mogwai, and My Bloody Valentine were the loudest bands I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've seen I've never seen Mogwai, but I saw My Bloody Valentine, and that was ear bleeding territory. For me, it would probably be them, Dinosaur Jr., and Motorhead.
Oh my god!
Because Lemmy is definitely up there for me as well. Since we're talking about bass players.
Well, speaking of basses, you typically play a Yamaha bass, right?
Yes.
What is it? Why that certain type or brand of bass? What about that do you prefer? And what's some other gear that you prefer to use?
So obviously my dad's relationship with Yamaha goes back to the late 70s. So he's been playing Yamaha BBs for over 40 years. And when we came to start touring, it was kind of like, you know, this is the bass to get that sound. So it was kind of non-negotiable that if you want to sound like Peter Hook, you've got to play a Yamaha, which is what makes me laugh about the current touring setup of New Order with a new bass player when he's playing a Fender Jack. And you'll never get the right sound out of a Fender Jack. But hey, I'm obviously biased.
I am too, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, if he's listening, get yourself a Yamaha and it'll sound a lot better. But I don't know, it's just, I started playing it then and I just love the way they feel and the way they sound. And if I pick up a Fender Jazz or a Precision, you know, I can play it fine. But it just doesn't feel right to me at this point, just because I'm so used to playing BBs. There's just something about the way that they feel, you know, they're not too heavy. You can throw them around quite a bit, which is good because I wear my guitar quite low, so it doesn't pull on your neck or anything. They're pretty lightweight. They sound great. The resonance is really good across the whole of the fretboard, so no notes go missing whether you're playing up high or playing like more traditional low bass. It's all present, and I don't know. I just love those guitars. Always have, and I think I always will. To be honest, I mean, I've got a couple of Fenders, but I just never play them. It was funny because the first time I ever rehearsed with the Pumpkins, Fender had sent two jazz basses because traditionally that was just the bass that is used for that band. And for the first couple of days I was playing it, but it didn't really, you know, I was playing it fine and it just didn't really feel right to me, but no one was complaining. So I just sort of went along with it. And it was kind of like on the third or fourth day where I can't remember who suggested, because I brought my own Yamaha, And we thought, let's just try that. And then everybody just preferred it. And I think I was a lot more comfortable playing it, which might have been part of that, right? It sounded better because I was playing better, maybe, being less less nervous about playing something kind of foreign.
Well, it's like when someone gets you a sweater for Christmas or something that you don't really like, but you feel compelled to wear it a couple times in front of them, you know?
I mean, the guy from Fender was really nice. He'd give us the guitars, and it's like, you don't want to say, oh, thanks, but no thanks. So I did play them. But I don't know, everything just clicked as soon as I started playing the Yamaha. And then since then, there was one song on the last tour where I used a Gibson to get a different sound for when we played Glow. Other than that, every show I've played with the Pumpkins has all been with Yamaha basses. And Scott from Yamaha, who looks after all the artist relations side of things, has been really, really supportive. And I can't thank them enough for everything they've done for me in terms of, supplying us with really good gear. And ever since they took over, they bought Ampeg, which is the main sort of bass amp to the standard company. So since they bought Ampeg, and then they bought Line 6, so now the whole rig is basically it couldn't have worked out better, really, because I was playing Ampeg anyway, and then I got the memo company. Like, oh, Yamaha just bought Ampeg, like, wow, cool.
It's all in house now.
It's all under one thing now, so I can just ring up Scott and annoy him for whenever I need anything.
That's awesome.
So you mentioned your first rehearsals with the Pumpkins. How did it begin? I think Billy performed with you and your dad at a certain point, right? Is that how your relationship, or just take us through how you started performing with the Pumpkins?
Yeah, so in 2001, when I was about 12, Billy actually toured as a touring guitar player for New Order for a few months in summer 2001. And the first time I ever remember meeting him was on that tour. I think it was at the Liverpool Olympia, which is a small venue in Liverpool in the UK, where New Order played in probably July-ish 2001. And at that point, I didn't really know much about him or who he was because I was so young. It was just like, oh, they've got a new band member. And then, so that was definitely the first time, but I don't really recall much about it. And I certainly don't think he would either. But probably a couple of years later, when I was around 14, 15, and I started getting into the Pumpkins, and then it all clicked in my head, like, oh shit, no way, that's that guy. I've met him. Wow, that's cool. So that was probably the start. And then, as I said, in 2010, because obviously New Order split up in 2006, and my dad had kind of not been doing anything for a few years, touring-wise. And 2010, it was the 30th anniversary of Ian Curtis passing away. Mm-hmm. And my dad thought it was a shame that no one was doing anything to sort of celebrate the music. Rather than, he didn't want to sort of mark the date of his death, but rather celebrate, you know, what he created and the music that they did together. And at the time, he didn't have a band. So put a band together, and we started playing the music. Now, when in December 2010, we got our first American tour, and we played at the Metro in Chicago, which is owned by Joe Shanahan, who's one of my dad's oldest friends. I think Joe was actually the first person to book New Order in America after Ian Curtis died in 1980 at the Metro. So that was quite cool for Dad to be back at the Metro. And Billy came down and sang with us at the Metro. I think he did Transmission and Love Will Tear Us Apart. And I remember, because at that point, you know, I'm just like a huge fan getting to play with Billy. It's like, oh my God, this is crazy. And I remember literally the last 30 seconds of the song before Billy was going to come on, I broke a string. So I couldn't play my regular bass. And because we hire gear when we're in the US, to sort of save on costs and shipping and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I remember the backup bass that they'd sent was this awful, terrible bass. It was like a knockoff Fender, you know, like a really cheap copy of a Fender. Mm-hmm. And the whole time where he was playing with us, I was thinking, this sounds terrible. And I can't believe this is my one chance to play with Billy Corgan. And I'm playing this terrible guitar. And it kind of ruined the whole thing for me. But luckily, the next year, 2011, on our second tour, he came and sang with us again. And then I felt better about that one because I had my regular guitar, which was nice. Right. So that was sort of, I guess that's the first time he saw me playing. And every time we'd play in Chicago, he'd come down, sometimes just on his own or sometimes with Jeff as well. Jeff would play guitar and Billy would sing on some Joy Division songs. So I guess it all sort of comes from that, really. And then in 2015, when they were getting ready for their summer tour, it was probably only about 5 or 6 months after I'd last seen them when they played with us for maybe the third or fourth time at the Metro. And that was when they asked us to come on just for that tour initially, which was, again, I keep saying mind-blowing, but that was mind-blowing for a big fan like me to get that opportunity, which is really cool. I remember exactly where I was when Jeff called me to tell me. I was sound checking in New Orleans with my dad, and I walked back in afterwards and he's like, "Are you okay? You're really pale." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry, I'm fine." I sort of processed it on my own for a couple of days and then told everybody, and everyone was really excited, which was nice. So since then, I think I must have played about 120 shows with them now, which is crazy.
Yeah, so many connections too. I mean, even just the Metro you mentioned being such an important or such a kind of key place for New Order. It was the first place in the U.S. Obviously, there's a big Pumpkins connection to that venue. Jimmy Chamberlain had a quote a couple years ago where he said, "The way that Jack plays is very reminiscent of the way that Billy played bass on a lot of the early Pumpkin stuff, because he and James were really big Joy Division and New Order fans. A lot of those bass parts were mimicking Peter's playing."
Yeah.
That's just one of many kind of, it seems like some kind of, there's some like lineage or some direct, obviously there's very direct connections, but I mean, what do you have any thoughts on just musically, like the connection between your dad's early music or your dad's bands and the stuff you guys played together and sort of going into the Pumpkins catalog?
It's interesting really, because Billy has said that to me before about certainly the earlier Pumpkins songs, where they call it the attack of a bass player. So how you pick attacks the strings. How he was trying to play on those records was like how he heard my dad playing on all those Joy Division songs. And I guess that was my whole sort of education as a touring musician, was playing those songs live. So I guess maybe you thought it might be a good idea, let's see if this guy can play the Pumpkin songs. And when I listen to him, I can hear it, like Billy's a really, really good bass player, a lot better bass player than me. And you can hear the influence certainly in his bass playing. I couldn't have got off to a better start really than having to play my dad's parts for 10 years. It prepared me well for playing these parts.
Right. Do you have a favorite Pumpkin song that you guys play or we're playing on a regular basis?
Of the ones we've played, probably I would say Through the Eyes of Ruby is definitely one of them that we played on the 2015 tour. And then probably Hummer that we've played on the last couple of tours. they're probably my two favorites, but I mean, I like so many others. I mean, I don't know if I'm sort of gravitate more towards the bassier ones. Like, I love a lot of the tracks from Gish, like Bury Me and I Am One, which I'm hoping one day might get to play those. We haven't played those yet. Crush as well, that's another big one. I mean, the bass playing on Gish is amazing. As a, you know, just to, if you just sit down and listen to the bass parts, which is what I do when I'm getting ready to go into rehearsals or whatever, I'll always start a couple months beforehand and just really get into the tracks, and you mm-hmm. can really hear some incredible bass playing.
Yeah, on Gish in particular, I feel like the bass it sort of is showcased. You know, there's more of a spotlight on it at several different moments.
And I mean, that might be part of the reason why I love that album so much subconsciously. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, and they're difficult to play as well, I've got to say. I think I would hate to go back and listen to the first time I played Shiva in rehearsals compared to how I play it now, because I'm sure it was nowhere near as good. I think with those songs, they just get better the more you play them. So that's I think that's all I can say about it, really. If something's difficult and challenging, you know, I'd be sat in the hotel room till 2 a.m. after rehearsals, like saying, I want to get this right for tomorrow. Like, I want to come back and I've got this, so we can move on to the next one. So it was cool. And I don't know. I mean, it just really fun songs to play. I guess that's the bottom line. You know, songs like Drown and Hummer that we played on the Shiny tour, and just really fun to play. I have such a great time playing those songs.
Yeah, that kind of goes into a listener question we had from David K, aka Smashing Pumpkins concert goer on Instagram. They ask, what's your favorite song you haven't played live yet?
Let me think. Maybe I Am One or Bury Me. I don't know whether that's a subconscious thing because the bass is so prominent in them, but I hope one day that we get to play those, or maybe Jelly Belly as well. That one would be up there for sure. I'd say it'd be one of those three. So I will keep my fingers crossed that one day when I get sent the list, a couple of those will be on it.
Yeah, us too, man. We can't wait till the concerts happen again.
Tell me about it.
Speaking of that, I mean, right now I'm sure you're very much missing it. But you know, beforehand, like you said, you played about 120 shows with the Pumpkins. What's that like? And do things get in a certain pattern, or does each show feel unique? How do you keep it fresh?
every show feels different. Because I mean, even if you know, to the outsider, someone could say, "Oh, it's the same set, or 99% the same set every night." But to us, it doesn't feel like that because the way we play them every night is different. You know, there'll be little things that people add, or little bits that people play that they didn't play last night that sounds amazing. Or Jimmy will do a different fill that takes the song in a totally different direction, and so it does feel like. It never feels like we're doing the same thing over and over. It feels like we're sort of in a space where we have a framework, but we can take it in various different directions each night, which is cool.
Yeah. And you've obviously, you know, the different tours you have, like you said, a set list with, I'm sure, some wiggle room and some sort of, you know, alternate options. But do you, in terms of learning this band's music, like, do you learn beyond what has been on the set list? Are you kind of like, is that something you've studied up on? Or, I mean, I guess everybody in the band, even if they've been in the band for 30 years, you know, you rehearse and you kind of bone up on what you're going to play. But I guess I'm just curious, like how much of the catalog, which is pretty huge, you've learned, or if Billy said, hey, guess what, surprise, we're gonna play this one, is that like a panic moment, or do you feel like that would be a fun challenge?
I'd always, the way I like to approach it is I like to try and be one step ahead. So if I'll get sent a list of, say, you know, 40 or 50 songs that will eventually be condensed to sort of 25-30, then I will make sure that I know all 50 of them, just on the off chance that someone says, well, maybe that one would be better in this spot than that one, because I don't want to waste anyone's time in rehearsals. You know what I mean? I just want to say, all right, yeah, I know that one. Let's give it a go. So I'll definitely try and do more than I'm asked, so I can sort of be one step ahead, or try to be. But and then on top of that, if there's some of my favorites that aren't on the list, I'll just put them in the Spotify playlist anyway when I'm learning, and just learn them because it's fun. And it sort of keeps it exciting. And because, I mean, rehearsals can get tough doing the same thing every day for an extended period of time can be hard sometimes. But that is how you end up with a great show, when you put when you put that work in at the start. So, I mean, for me, typically before whatever the first rehearsal is, I'll be starting 2 or 3 months before that with a huge list of songs that I just make a Spotify playlist, and I stand in front of my TV as the songs are playing, and I just play along to them and figure them out. And that's pretty much, I mean, it's not very exciting, but that's how I do it.
That's awesome.
Well, so for the Shiny tour was a huge, huge show, three hour plus show.
I think the record was like 3 hour 22 at one point.
And we both saw it in LA, and it was great.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, amazing show. And seeing it was not only a great experience, but I you know, even as like a non-musician, pretty much, I was like, holy shit, this seems, I could sense the amount of work that must have had to go into it.
Oh yeah.
I'm just curious, what was the rehearsal period, or the sort of, you know, what was the lead up to that particular tour like? What was like a day for you guys?
So that tour started in July, didn't it? Like mid-July was the kickoff, 2018. And I think we started rehearsals sort of early May, because I remember flying out to Chicago very early May and to start rehearsals. But I probably started on the tunes in sort of February, March, like kind of around when the tour was announced. There was sort of a working list of songs that I was keen to get my hands on as soon as possible, really, so I could get a head start. Because at that point, I mean, for me, it had been, you know, best part of 3 years since I'd last played with them. So it was even the ones that I'd played on the 2015 tour, you know, I needed to really practice to sort of get the chops back. So we probably started early May for a good like 2 months of rehearsals. And the typical day would probably be me and James would, because we were staying in the same hotel, because everybody else was living in Chicago, would drive in together to rehearsals at about 10 or 11. And then we'd typically be there till sort of 6-7. And, you know, with taking lunch breaks and regular breaks, it's not like it's just full pelt 8 hours rehearsal. You know, we'd have dinner and stuff like that. But, you know, there were long days, but like, as I said, that's how you get such a great, that's how we came out with such a great show. I mean, what, to me, it's like, I wanted, there's so many things were going on that stage in terms of moving parts and crazy lights and videos and cues and places where you couldn't stand because you didn't want to get wiped out by like a moving video screen.
Right.
So I was thinking, all right, well, I don't want to have to think about what I'm doing. I want to get to the point where I can just play the song kind of without thinking about it, because then I can concentrate on the rest of it. So for me, it was like, 2 months, great. Can we do 4?
Right.
You know, I want to do more. So I was not to me, you can't rehearse enough, really, especially for a tour of that size. I was overjoyed to find out that we were doing so much rehearsing, which was great, really. I mean, it just makes everything better, because by the time you've been in rehearsals for 2 months, you feel ready to go and play a show. Like, you can't wait to go and play a show. And then it just sort of makes that moment where you play for the first time in front of people, when you've spent so much time in a room with 10 people, it just makes that sort of opening night all the more magical, really.
Well, cut to, so that was your 2018 and 2019, and then we all know how 2020 turned out. Yeah. So how's it been for you, just in, you know, generally in terms of life, but also creatively? Have you, obviously, you know, no touring, what have you been up to for the past, for this fucked up year that we've all been through?
Yeah, it's been difficult, man, I gotta say. I mean, for me, I've been a touring musician since May 2010. So that's, you know, a third of my life has been spent, just fully spent touring. So when it all disappeared, you're just kind of like, shit, what do I do now? And at first everyone was kind of like, because I had quite a busy year. It was looking like a busy year for 2020, because there was a couple of Pumpkins tours, and in the middle I was going to go back to playing with my dad, which I was really looking forward to, because I hadn't played with him since 2017. So it was looking like a really busy year, and I was really excited. And just as we were getting to the point where things were starting to happen, obviously everything shut down. So it's been really difficult. It's sort of like, as we say in Manchester, 2020 has been a bit of a shit sandwich. Sure. Because we're sort of eating the coronavirus, and then we've also got Brexit, which is fully fucking up everyone's touring plans for whenever, whenever stuff does start happening again.
Right.
Certainly British bands have kind of got this double blow of, oh, I'm desperate to get back out there, but it's a lot more difficult now because of this other thing. Right, so yeah. it's been a really uninspiring year for me, just like watching all this happen and thinking like, is touring ever going to come back? And if it does come back, is it even going to be anything like how it was? I really don't know. I mean, in terms of touring with the Pumpkins, I don't think it'll be that much different, because our tour manager is used to applying for non-EU sort of work permits for a whole bunch of American people. So for him, it's just like another name on his list that he has to get a visa for now. But in terms of touring with my dad, like, it's going to have a huge impact on how we tour Europe. So I'm as much as I can't wait for touring to come back, I'm sort of worried that we're going to get to that point and say like, oh, now we're allowed back out on the road, it doesn't actually look like we can because of A, B, and C.
Right.
So I'm sort of very worried about that. But yeah, the last year has been tough. I mean, there's a lot of people, certainly in our industry, who have been totally left behind by our not so wonderful government, which are not very keen to help people in our sector, shall we say. So there's a lot of people I know who are suffering, you know, crew and touring musicians like myself. So it has been difficult, but you know, it sort of feels like we've got a bit of light at the end of the tunnel now. I can finally sort of think maybe by the end of this year, might we be playing some shows? I don't know. So we'll have to just wait and see. I mean, my calendar at the moment, it was really full. Now it isn't. But the sort of everything keeps getting pushed back further and further back. So at the moment, I think the next thing that I actually have is in July or something like that with my dad. July and August, we've got some festivals that are still insisting that they're going to go ahead. It will remain to be seen whether that happens. And then in September, we've got a couple of festivals with the Pumpkins, at Riot Fest, and I can't remember the name of the other one, but they're announced and on sale and stuff, but I haven't heard anything since then. So I'm just sort of looking at that and thinking, let's just aim for that. And if that happens, great. If it doesn't, at this point, I won't be that surprised.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the Riot Fest date, I remember that, I believe, you know, it's in September 2021, which is this year. Just doing
it's already
math,
been pushed back a year.
Yeah, they pushed it a full year in September or leading, you know, in the summer. Mm. And at that point, you know, I feel like we've crossed a threshold a while ago of this sort of false hope of like, well, maybe this will be over next month. You know, obviously it's like we're in this for the long haul. But that's been a date, that September 21 Riot Fest, you know, what, not even if I go to it or not, but like, it's, I just want it to happen. You know, it feels at the time it felt like ample time. Now it feels like still hopeful, you know, still within the realm of possibility. So hopefully it does.
The way that it is here at the moment, I don't know about the States, but everyone sort of, all the people who had loads of gigs in 2020 rescheduled them all for 2021. Mm-hmm. Right. So now it doesn't look like they're going to happen. So now you're looking at sort of, can we move that to the end of the year? And then you're being told, no, all the venues are booked up now from the people that moved their end of 2020 shows to the end of 2021. So then you go, okay, well, when can I play this show? And now you're looking like the queue is so big of bands trying to book gigs that we're being, you know, my dad's being told now that it's like April 2022, you know, just.
Yeah.
And you're going, oh my God, we're only in January 21. Like, I've got another year and a bit of no work.
Yeah, because obviously, like, from a fan's perspective, maybe people think, like, oh, as soon as it's safe to do it again, you could just start tour. But, like, a big, big tour, obviously, you can't, it, like, takes some planning. And, like you said, now everybody is in the same boat of having pushed back. And
it's, yeah, there's a queue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you wanted to say, like, I want to do a huge tour in spring 2022, then you're going to be told, well, all these venues that you want to play are all booked up from people who've moved their spring 2021 gigs already. Yeah. So it's going to take years for the full sort of music industry to get back on its feet, which is worrying, not only as a fan who loves going to shows, which I do, but certainly as somebody who sort of works in that field, it's depressing, man. I got to tell you, it's, I was speaking to my dad about it just yesterday, and he was like, I haven't had to have a real job for 40 years and I might have to go and get a real job. And I'm like, I think you'll be okay, but it's going to be a fucking long time. But it's basically what we were saying. I mean, it's just, it's tough, man. I mean, I don't know anybody that's not missing gigs. It's just every conversation I have with someone is either, I really miss playing a gig, or I'm really missing working at a gig, or I'm really missing going to a gig. Really affecting everybody, which is sad, really. I mean, I think the last gig I went to was in November 2019. Mm-hmm. So we're like nearly 18 months without going to a gig. Which feels so crazy, because I mean, I'm fortunate that here in Manchester we're on everybody's tour schedule, so there's always bands coming through, and I'm probably at a gig every couple of weeks normally, and then to go from that to nothing has been really weird. I think even if you take out the fact that I'm not able to play as my job, just not being able to go to other people's gigs is really, really sad.
Yeah. And at first, I think there was an ability at first to sort of, I feel like the toll is taken sort of on a delay. Like, you can kind of suck it up for a while and think, like, you know, just got to get through this. It'll happen again. But over the long haul, it starts to become really depressing, you know?
I feel like I'm in that stage at the moment. I was looking at the calendar, and I think on the 28th of February, so the end of this month, it'll have been 18 months since my last show that I played, which would have been the final show on the Pumpkins tour with Noel Gallagher, which was at the end of August 2019. Because I knew that after that tour, I was going to have some time off, because the Pumpkins didn't have anything planned for, until what would have been that Rock Invasion 2 tour. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had a sort of window, and it's not like I can just click my fingers and go back to my dad's band, because they had another bass player filling in for me. They were on the road already. So I knew that I was going to have potentially sort of 4 or 5 months off anyway. But then when that turns into 18, and I know nobody could see this pandemic coming, but yeah, it's been tough, man. It's been really tough. Mm-hmm.
Well, to kind of shift gears slightly to something a little bit more positive, since you brought up Noel Gallagher, one of our listeners, Brian Ross from the UK, actually has a question about what it was like touring with Noel Gallagher. And what was the relationship with the High Flying Birds? Was it friendly or just professional?
Oh no, it was really, really friendly. We had such a great time on that tour. It was just so much fun. It was weird because usually on a normal Pumpkins tour, sort of I'm the only British guy around, and nobody else wants to watch the football or the soccer, I suppose you would say, and stuff like that. So I'm sort of like, all right, yeah, whatever, okay. And then this time there was like tons of British football fans around, so it was like, oh, fantastic! This is great. I've always got something to talk to everybody about in catering, which is nice. And I mean, I was growing up, I was a massive Oasis fan, probably before I sort of found like all the American bands that I got into. In my early teens, I was a huge Oasis fan. And still, I mean, I'm not as much these days, but I still love those classic tunes. And especially live, they really come alive in a live setting. So it was, I mean, when I saw that bill, when I got the email saying like, oh, here's the summer dates. And there's been a couple of emails floating around about who the other bands were going to be on the bill. And I thought it was a completely different lineup. I can't remember exactly what it was, but, and then I got the email and it was like, oh, here's the dates for the tour with Noel and AFI. I was like, oh, wow. No way. Like, I know people on Noel's crew. Like, I never met Noel, but I knew his tech used to be a drum tech in New Order, Nicky, who I knew quite well from back in the day. So it was cool to see some familiar faces and then get to meet some really lovely new people, which was great. And Noel was great as well. The relentless piss taking on that tour, just because that's the I think that tends to be the way British people tour. It's just relentless piss taking and relentless football banter. It was Noel being a Manchester City fan and me being a Manchester United fan. There was sort of this running narrative on the whole tour that people were trying to pit us against each other. But it was funny. It was great, really. Quite surreal to be sat backstage watching Premier League football games with Noel Gallagher. he tends to always, and even if you weren't watching them with him, if I was in the catering room watching United or whatever, and we'd go one down, just like magic, Noel would appear to rub it in. So it was quite funny, really. And the ongoing theme was, we gotta get a photo together. We gotta get a photo together. Manx on tour. So I was like, all right, we'll get a photo. And every time I went to get the photo, he's like, come on, we'll do it in front of my flag. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And I went in his dressing room. And in his dressing room, he's got a massive Manchester City flag that he was saying, you've got to stand in front of this. And he goes, I've had David Beckham in front of this, and I've had Eric Cantona in front of this. And he's like, every Manchester United legend that has a picture of me, they get it done in front of this flag. So I was like, all right, I'm going to try my best to not to not have that. So I waited. Right. I waited until the last night of the tour at Shoreline Amphitheatre in San Jose or somewhere in the Bay Area. And I waited until they pulled the flag down, and then I went over and said, "Well, no, we got to have that photo." He's like, "Where's the flag? Where's the flag?" It's like, "Oh, it's in the bus." I'm like, "Yes, I did it. Sorry, I absolutely did it." So I did get my photo with Noel without the flag, which I was very pleased with. I don't know if he was, but I was very pleased with that. But no, it was fun. His band were amazing, and both in terms of every night
they played amazing and went down amazing with the crowd, but also off stage they were really, really nice and really friendly. We had a couple of great days off where sort of everybody did stuff together and it was a really nice vibe. I remember we had a great day in Cleveland when we all went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Most of the band and most of both bands and crew all went there together and had a great time, and I'm still in touch with most of Noel's crew. Even 18 months on, I'm still texting people, so it's been good to definitely meet some friends for life. It was nice.
Yeah, it seemed like a great... I remember seeing a photo of it was a big group photo of all the bands and crew, and just, you know, it everybody looked very happy.
Yeah.
Did you have the same experience with AFI with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Crew? Yeah. I mean, I knew Davey a little bit because he played with the Pumpkins a couple of times. He'd got on stage to sing, so I knew Davey, but I didn't really know the rest of the band. And then, exactly the same vibe with them. Really friendly. Off stage, everyone's having a great time. Backstage was like just a really nice family atmosphere. Sort of, you wanted to go in earlier and earlier each day so you could just hang around and banter with everybody. So it was it was nice.
It's a really great cross-section of bands. They all each feels connected to the other, but in totally different ways.
Yeah.
Almost like the Pumpkins are like the center, and then, you know, Noel and Oasis stuff and AFI are kind of like on either side of, you know, it's like a diverse lineup, but also it kind of makes sense. Like,
yeah, it was great. I mean, some of my friends were like, how does that bill work? Like, AFI are nothing like Noel, and Noel's nothing like the Pumpkins. Yeah. And I'm like, no, man, it works. Trust me. It's just a great vibe each night. It was a really fun tour. And by the end of it, the general consensus amongst everybody was, I wish it had been a bit longer. You know what I mean? Because it was it was a relatively short tour, really. It was only like 3.5 weeks, I think. And the vibe amongst everybody was, yeah, I could do another month of this, maybe. So it was a shame that we didn't do more, but you never know, one day.
Yeah. Well, we can't wait. I imagine Davey and AFI, I imagine they're probably fans of your dad's music.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was funny because when Davey in particular is a massive Joy Division New Order fan. And I remember what year was it? 2018, when we did that 30th anniversary show. And my dad came out to play with the Pumpkins, and we did a few Joy Division and New Order songs at the as like the encore, and Davey was singing. And I remember backstage he was showing my dad all of his New Order and Joy Division tattoos. Like, he's got Love Will Tear Us Apart like tattooed across his chest, and my dad was like, you man. He was like, no, please, can we get a picture with you pointing at me tattoo? It was like, it was cool. Yeah, it was fun. I think my dad still finds it a bit weird that people get tattoos of his music, and he was kind of blown away by all these tattoos that Davey had. And it was the same later that year when Drab Majesty opened for us. And I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy from Drab Majesty was showing me all his New Order tattoo. It's fun.
Yeah, that's got to be kind of surreal. But also, I mean, it's not like you're not aware that people are big fans of the music, but yeah.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a fan too. So it's just like, it just turns into a bunch of people geeking out.
Speaking of geeks, if you don't mind, we have just a couple more questions from our listeners.
Yeah, no worries.
We don't want to keep you all day or all night.
Oh, trust me, I've got nothing else to do, so this is great. You can keep me for as long as you want, because if I go downstairs, all it's going to be is miserable news.
All right, well then we'll buckle up. So Justin Reeves asks, I vaguely recall you mentioning how much you loved playing Geek USA during the End Times tour because it was one of your favorite songs. What was your first Pumpkins album and experience listening when you were younger? I think you said Siamese Dream.
Yeah.
And also, You Rock Live, thank you. So maybe less of a question and more of a...
Oh, that's cool. No, I remember
for that 2015 tour, that was kind of a late addition to the set list, really. And I remember being really excited, like getting to play that song, but then also really scared trying to keep up with Jimmy. The first time, I would never want to go back and listen to the first time I played it, but by the end of it, we were rocking it. I thought it sounded great. And again, so hopefully one day maybe that one will come back. But that was definitely a fun one. I mean, that is a tough song to play. When that thing is with that song, when that train is rolling, if you fall off, you ain't getting back on.
Yeah, right.
So you've got to be right in the pocket to get on board with that one. And from a fan perspective, obviously getting to listen to Jimmy play that was just crazy. And just to watch him effortlessly play something like that, which is, you know, one of the songs that I've been listening to for 15, 16 years, one of my favorite Pumpkin songs, just to be stood there in that moment watching him play. And it's just like, wow. It's crazy.
Someone recently on Instagram had posted a live, some around like the 94 era of them playing that song, and just Jimmy is just like looking like he's not breaking a sweat whatsoever, and what you're hearing is just absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It just regularly blows my mind when I look over. And I mean, probably the best example of that on the last tour was Super Christ, when we were playing that song. And his drumming is just I'm running out of superlatives, just ridiculous to listen to what he was doing every night. And he's barely even, it doesn't even look like he's moving, you know. Most drummers, when you see crazy drums, the kind of arms are everywhere and they're going crazy, and Jimmy's just, it's just always in control and just so powerful, and every night completely different. Like by the end of the tour with Noel, we were sort of laughing about it each night because he was doing crazier and crazier fills, and I'm sort of egging him on each night, like, to do that again that you did the other night, do that, you know. And then so that sort of felt like a big song for the rhythm section. It was cool.
He's incredible. Well, he's very complimentary of you too. I mean, that's got to be, I mean, probably not, because like you said, you've been a touring musician with big bands and you've been playing for a really long time, so obviously, you know, obviously you can hang, but is it at all, I mean, just with Jimmy in particular, he's so just such an amazing
force of nature,
one of the very best, you know. Yeah, just amazing and also unique, like not just proficient in the way that other drummers are, but just truly has his own thing going on of like power and like grace and, like you said, control, you know. Is it at all, or was it at any point, like, scary or intimidating to be on stage with them or with anybody in the band?
Not really, just because they've all made me feel so welcome. And I mean, the first time I met Jimmy was probably like 2009, maybe, when Pumpkins played the Manchester Arena on the Zeitgeist tour, and me and my dad went to watch the show. And before the show, we were backstage with Billy and Jimmy. And that's probably, so even Jimmy, I've known him for a long time. So it didn't feel
sort of scary, but there is that thing in the back of your mind, like, am I good enough to play with him? You know? Mm-hmm. You start thinking like, ooh, getting a bit worried maybe. But no, I mean, they all make you feel so, or they've certainly made me feel so welcome, and they're all so supportive of your playing that it just makes everything so so much easier. Mm-hmm. Just having, they're all in your corner. They all want you to do well. And, mm-hmm. you know, but also if you're doing something wrong, they'll tell you, which I love, you know, it's, yeah. I don't want people to just be nice to me in the hope that I'll get it right. Like, if I'm getting it wrong, please tell me. And they right. do. And then eventually, you know, we'll get it. And I feel like me and Jimmy at the moment are certainly towards the end of the last tour, we were really, really locked in, like better than we'd ever been. Even on the 2018 tour, it felt like to me, it just felt like it was getting better and better and better. Which again is a bummer about it being so long since the last show now. But I mean, hopefully, in the near future, whenever we can play again, it'll all click back into place, and I'm sure it will.
But
I mean, it was funny because when when I got the call to do the 2015 tour, Jimmy hadn't officially signed on for that tour at that point. And I was under the impression that I was going to be playing with a different drummer. I think it was kind of 3 or 4 days before I was going to fly out to start the rehearsals. I got the email that Jimmy was back, and I did have a moment like, oh my God, you know, and I was thinking like, oh, am I going to be able to do this? It was a little bit worrying for a while, and then the proposed set list that I'd been sort of been working towards did change a little bit, and you know, all of a sudden songs like Geek were coming back in, and it was like, okay, I've got to put some hours in the hotel room here.
right.
So it was good. No, but I mean, it's such great fun playing with him, and playing with a drummer like him has definitely improved my bass playing like 100 times. Like, I'm such a better bass player for having played with him for the last 5 years, like, without a doubt. And he probably doesn't even know it, but he's definitely just by him setting that level of performance that I am forced to match, has definitely made me such a better musician. So I can't thank all of them enough, really, for everything they've done. It's been really, really good. And it's always just felt like family at this point. I mean, even that, I'd never met James before the 2018 tour. Oh, wow. The first time I met him was at the first rehearsal. And now we text all the time. Like, it's just, really? Yeah, it just feels like a total, just a friend that you've known for ages. So everyone's been really, really nice and supportive and welcoming. And I'm just very, very lucky. I'm the fan that gets to play in the band. That's literally what it is. Yeah. It just is crazy.
That's what, because one of our listeners, Will Alexander, kind of asked that about, like, anything that surprised you about the dynamics of the band now that you're a touring bassist and no longer simply a listener. And also that he says much respect to you. but yeah, so that would be, it's just more of like, it feels more like a family than say like a job.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It was never at one point, never have I ever dreaded going into rehearsals. Do you know what I mean? It's just like excitement to see everyone and as excited just to sit around bullshitting at lunch as I am to go in and play the tunes. And that's what makes this whole thing even worse, as I just really miss everybody. It's tough. So, you know, I do try and keep in contact with everyone on text or email or whatever, but I miss everybody in the band and crew. And it's, you know, it's difficult being, obviously, you know, they're all based in the US and I'm over here in the UK. It is difficult sometimes keeping in touch, but I feel like we're doing all right.
Yeah. Well, we can't wait to see you guys perform again. You really do all sound so great together. And it does seem like a really healthy period for the band, you know, as longtime fans, that's like it's very exciting to just kind of, obviously coronavirus and all these other catastrophic events aside, to just get to look forward to, you know, a healthy band and certainly very prolific band being around for a while. You know, we look forward to seeing you guys play.
Me too.
Again and again.
Me too. More than anything at the moment, I'm really missing it. I'm just missing everybody. As I said, just even the vibe of just rehearsals or backstage or whatever. And the vibe with the crew. I miss all the crew guys. It's tough, but we will get through it eventually, I hope.
Yeah.
Yes, we will. We shall. Yeah, and there's definitely the nice, the silver lining about just live music from a fan and from a professional standpoint is that there's very much a will to, you know, people want it, you know? I mean, people have spent this pandemic trying desperately to figure out ways to substitute that experience, and there kind of is no substitute
Definitely.
Which is what we've confirmed. So
I mean, I was speaking to my dad about that, and he was sort of having a moment. I mean, and that's crazy to think that someone who's been in the music industry for 45 years would have this moment, but he was like, is there even going to be an audience there when we do get back? Are people still going to care? And I'm like, Dad, people are going to care more than ever.
Yeah. I think that part is true. That's like, not even just wishful thinking. However long it takes, people will be desperate for that experience.
Yeah. I was saying to him, like, you've got to hold on to that feeling that just think how great it's going to be. Because my dad always says the best moment of a show for him is when he walks out on stage, puts his guitar on, and just that little 5 seconds of silence, but you know, that sort of feeling where no one knows what the first song is going to be. And you're looking at all these people and they're looking back at you. He loves that. And I said, you just got to hold on to that, because just think how great it's going to be that first time back. And you know, even if it's another year or whatever, you know, people are going to want to see you more than ever. I mean, it's usually me that has these moments, but it was quite interesting that sort of he was having one. And I was like, people want to hear your bass, and people are always going to want to hear your bass. And by the time we can gig again, you know, people are going to be more thirsty for it than ever before. I was just trying to, like big him up. You know, it's going to be great. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But it's probably going to be a long time.
it might be a minute, but that moment that he was describing will be more poignant than ever, you know, because this is a very pregnant pause that we're in right now. And the hunger from fans is definitely, I think, very strong.
Well, one thing I can say from sort of the other side of it is that the hunger from musicians and touring professionals in general, and crew guys and musicians and everyone, is that it's exactly the same for us. We just can't wait to get back out there. So I hope it isn't too long. I mean, just this year would be nice. We're in sort of mid-February now, aren't we? Just this year would be nice. I'm trying to hold on to that.
same. Well, Jack, we don't want to keep you all night, but thank you so much for chatting with us. It's been really fun.
No worries, man. Thanks for inviting us on.
Yeah.
And we can't wait to see you. Can't wait to see you perform again.
Whenever the next show is, make sure you come and say hello. It'd be nice to meet you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely be trying to wave our pumpkin press passes around, trying to get backstage, trying to do some kind of like Laverne and Shirley type of, you know, scheming to get back.
They'll have to be a sort of on location live episode or something.
We'll
disguise ourselves as pizza delivery guys.
Totally. That's the best way to get backstage.
It's always pizza delivery. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, everyone wants pizza.
I've just given away the secret.
Right. We'll cut that out. We'll edit that.
All right.
Yeah. All right, Jack. Thank you so much for chatting with us. Be well. And we'll be in touch.
All right, man. Thanks for having us. See you in a bit.
Take care.
And that was our interview with Jack Bates. What a great guy.
Super great guy. Yeah, really delightful chatting with him. And man, oh man, that really made me just hungrier than ever to and hopeful too. I know we were sort of lamenting the, you know, how shitty it's been, but like I think the nice part is like it's I really think it's true that like as much of a long haul and how as shitty as this is on so many levels for music fans and for just any live art experiences and connection with people, like that's not going away. That's only gonna be more important. So that's, you know, that part is hopeful.
Yeah. Something I guess it would have been hard to kind of bring up in conversation, because I guess this is more for like us, you know, talking afterwards about Jack. I think people don't give enough credit to the fact of what he brought to, you know, what he brings to the Pumpkins live sound. I know that, you know, there are a lot of people who are bummed about, like, you know, Darcy not being part of the, the reunion. But, I mean, they sound incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that he doesn't get enough credit for just how good they sound. He's not just a hired gun. I think like he really brought a lot to those shows, or he really brings a lot to those shows. And I don't think he gets enough credit for that, because I think he sounds fantastic, and I think he's a really good addition.
And I definitely, that was made real for me at the end of that Shiny show, the 3 hours plus into it of like songs from all over the map, and it just sounded, I was like, holy shit, you know, I could fully appreciate his contribution to the band. And what a nice guy too.
Well, that will do it for this episode of the Smashing Pumpcast. If you would like to reach out to us, you can reach us on the socials on Twitter at Pumpkins Podcast, or you can reach us on Instagram at Smashing Pumpcast. And that cast is spelled KAST. Or you could also email us at thesmashingpumpcast@gmail.com. And cast is spelled KAST.
That's right. And we got lots more stuff, lots more exciting stuff coming your way. So stay tuned and keep those fingers crossed and those prayer hands prayerful about us getting to all see live music again together someday, because that's going to be great. And until then,
yep,
we bid you all farewell and
good night.